Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. You're tuned in to Columbo Chronicles at Blog Talk Radio. Follow the mover and shaker, award-winning author and host, seen on TV and radio, Rose Columbo. Every Wednesday, Rose interviews prominent experts and authors on politics and social justice. Call in and listen or ask the guest the question at 646-564-9742. Now, here's Rose.
Hello, everyone out there in the USA and around the world. You're tuned in to Columbo Chronicles Live, right here with Rose Columbo every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and that's 11 to midnight for all you sleepyheads out there on the East Coast. Check your time in your area. So go grab yourself a cup of hot tea or coffee, because coming up shortly is a very popular guest, as seen on national TV and heard on radio by demand, Dan Pila, author of 11 books and tax expert. He's going to answer the question, can you win your tax audit, and do we have rights if contacted by the IRS? I think we've all had questions about the IRS and our taxes, and if we're contacted by the IRS, we feel a little weak in our knees and probably feel like fainting before we open up the envelope to see what's in it. So stay tuned and don't miss this exciting interview, because he has a wealth of information that you can't get anywhere else. So since we have the tax man coming up in a little bit, I thought we'd start off with a brief history of the IRS. And before we talk about the IRS and the history of the IRS, let's take a little break, grab that cup of coffee, hot tea, and we'll be back in just.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics, from politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up, Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc, Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, we're back on Columbo Chronicles Live, and I'm going to discuss a brief history of the IRS before our exciting guest, Dan Pila, author and tax expert, joins us. Origin of the history of the IRS, briefly, is that the roots of the IRS go back to the Civil War, when President Lincoln and Congress in 1862 created the position of Commissioner of Internal Revenue and enacted an income tax to pay for war expenses. The income tax was repealed 10 years later. Congress revived the income tax in 1894, but the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional the following year. The 16th Amendment in 1913, Wyoming ratified the 16th Amendment, providing the three-quarter majority of states necessary to amend the Constitution. The 16th Amendment gave Congress the authority to enact an income tax. There's a lot of controversy over the income tax. Many people think we do not have to pay the income tax, and other people say we do. It is controversial. That same year, the first Form 1040 appeared after Congress levied a 1% tax on net personal incomes above $3,000 with a 6% surtax on income of more than $500,000. In 1918, during World War I, the top rate of the income tax rose to 77% to help finance the war effort. It dropped sharply in the post-war years, down to 24% in 1929, and rose again during the Depression. During World War II, Congress introduced payoff. I think that's what they're doing today. Payoff. Must have been on my mind there. 6% surtax on income of more than $500,000. In 1918, during World War I, the top rate of the income tax rose to 77%. And we don't think that it could rise that high. But as they are flooding our nation with unidentified foreigners from around the Middle East and China and South America and Mexico and other countries, we are going to experience an increase because Obama racked up the national debt, trillions of dollars. Someone has to sustain it, or the economy will crash as they allowed millions of these unidentified foreigners into our country and forced Americans to pay the taxes for their HUD, for their food stamps, for their job training, if there is any job training, student loans for all of their living expenses, including the travel expenses, where Obama flew them into the USA secretly at night through his pre-planned executive order that the Democratic Congress did not nullify or repeal or prohibit from doing. So you're talking about trillions more dollars that are draining the entitlement programs paid by we, the people, who are legal naturalized Americans, or like myself, legal natural born Americans. And those entitlement programs were intended for legal Americans who are down and out on their luck, and for future generations of legal Americans. But it's going to drain the economy, and it's not going to come out of thin air, trillions of dollars to pay for the living expenses and the Obamacare and the HUD and food stamps for the millions of unidentified illegal foreign enemies and legal foreigners in our country. It is a mixed batch of foreigners. And it could increase our taxes up to 77% or higher to help finance this war effort right here in the good old USA, economic warfare. Anyway, the history is that it dropped sharply in the post-war years down to 24% in 1929. And rose again during the Depression. During World War II, Congress introduced payroll withholding and quarterly tax payments. In the 50s, the agency was reorganized to replace a patronage system with career professional employees. The Bureau of Internal Revenue got a new name, and it was changed to the Internal Revenue Service, which we call out as the IRS. Only the IRS Commissioner and Chief Counsel and selected by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. Today's IRS organization. The IRS Restructuring and Reform Act of 1998 prompted the most comprehensive reorganization and modernization of IRS in nearly a half a century. The IRS reorganized itself to closely resemble the private sector model of organizing around customers with similar needs. Do you think the IRS modeled itself after the private sector businesses and provide excellent customer service where the customer comes first? I don't know. I'm just asking a question. You decide. So in today's world, that was just a brief history of the IRS and how it got started. In today's world, from Wikipedia, it says there's an IRS scandal, and it's involving the IRS. In 2013, the United States Internal Revenue Service revealed that it had selected political groups applying for tax-exempt status for intensive scrutiny based on their names or political themes. This led to wide condemnation of the agency and triggered several investigations, including a Federal Bureau of Investigation criminal probe ordered by the United States Attorney General Eric Holder. Now, this was, I think this came after the scandal of Fast and Furious when Eric Holder was the former USAG and he was in charge of the program titled Fast and Furious. Now we're into another scandal with the IRS in 2013. And Lois Lerner was the director of the IRS. So this is, in my opinion, profiling people. Anyway, the article says that the initial reports described the selections as nearly exclusively of conservative groups with terms such as Tea Party in their names. According to Republican lawmakers, liberal-leaning groups and the Occupy movement had also triggered additional scrutiny, but at a lower rate than conservative groups. The Republican majority on the House Oversight Committee issued a report which concluded that although some liberal groups were selected for additional review, the scrutiny that these groups received did not amount to targeting when compared to the greater scrutiny received by conservative groups. The report was criticized by the committee's Democratic minority, which said that the report ignored evidence that the IRS used keywords to identify both liberal and conservative groups. In January of 2014, the FBI told Fox News that its investigation had found no evidence so far warranting the filing of federal criminal charges in connection with the controversy, as it had not found any evidence of enemy hunting, and that the investigation continued with the IRS and Lois Lerner, who ended up taking the Fifth Amendment. On October 23, 2015, the Justice Department declared that no criminal charges would be filed against Lois Lerner, the former director of the IRS, and their staff. And on that note, We've had a little brief history of the IRS and how the IRS targeted and profiled Americans. So there you have it. And now we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to a dynamic personality, Dan Pilla. He's the author of 11 books and the tax expert. So don't touch that dial, because I will be back in just a moment.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening. Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, we're back on Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo, and we're about to speak and welcome our very special guest, Dan Pilla, and he is his online web is taxhelponline.com. He's written 11 books. In 1974, the IRS seized his father's business for back debts, and they padlocked the doors and auctioned the equipment off for a few cents on the dollar. And this led to Mr. Pilla becoming an expert researching and documenting and exposing how Americans can protect themselves from the IRS. And he's going to tell us if we have any rights if the IRS contacts us, and give us some really great tips. So don't touch that dial, and let's say hello to Dan Pilla. Hi, Dan. How are you today?
I am well, Rose. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. It's good to talk to you again, and understand that you have some really great information about, is the IRS friendly, or should we be afraid of the IRS when we receive that letter in the mail, if we receive that letter in the mail?
Well, I'm certainly no advocate of being afraid of the IRS, Rose. You know, I've written, you mentioned 11. Actually, the number is 14 books, but who's counting? 14 books on dealing with the IRS and taxpayers' rights issues and IRS problems resolution. So I've been doing this work an awful long time, helping people solve problems with the IRS. And the one thing I've proven over and over again, Rose, is you don't have to be afraid of the IRS. People are afraid of the agency because people are largely ignorant of what their rights are. And frankly, the IRS has got a lot of power. There's no doubt about that. But when you understand what your rights are and you understand what the limitations are that the IRS has to operate under, then you don't have to be you don't have to be afraid. You're not going to be run over by the agency.
Can the IRS send you a letter And should you, I mean, not send you a letter, they do send you letters, but can the IRS call you on the phone? And should you answer any questions on the phone if the if someone says they are from the IRS?
Well, let's talk about a cold call, Rose. I mean, there's two different kinds of contacts that could be made. If you've got an active audit going, for example, if you're dealing with an auditor right now, and you've been in a meeting with an auditor, you've had an opportunity to present documents and answer questions and you know, raise your points and so forth, it's not at all unusual for there to be phone calls back and forth between the IRS and individuals, and certainly between IRS and their representatives. You know, I'm dealing with phone calls every day from IRS personnel, whether it's auditors or collection agents, IRS collection officers or appeals officers that are you know, involved in the cases that I'm involved with. So that's a common thing. Here's what is not common, and this is what is scamming thousands of Americans every day, and that is the IRS will never contact you by telephone in the first instance, Rose. So in other words, if you're going along through your daily affairs and you're not dealing with the IRS, and suddenly, out of the clear blue, you get a phone call from somebody pretending to be from the IRS that says you owe them money, and if you don't pay today, they're going to send somebody out to arrest you. Rose, that's an absolute guaranteed scam. The IRS does not work that way. First of all, they will never, even if they think you committed a crime, okay? First of all, statistically speaking, Rose, you got a better chance of being eaten by a shark than you do of going to jail for a tax crime. So, I mean, the simple fact that that somebody's on the phone threatening to put you in jail is right away, I mean, just off the bat, without even any further discussion, we know that's a scam, because the IRS just never works that way in a criminal case. But the fact of the matter is, in a legitimate criminal situation, they are never going to tell you either you pay today or you go to jail. That is just not how they work. If it's a legitimate debt situation, that is to say the IRS thinks you owe money, they're going to send a series of collection notices before any phone calls are ever made. You're going to get notices in the mail. The notices are going to come in the form of adjustment notices that say, we adjusted your account. You used to owe X, now you owe Y. Here's our explanation. Those are adjustment letters. There's a series of those letters. And then they start with the collection notices after they've sent their last adjustment letter that says, here's what you owe. Then they start the letters that say, hey, you've got this debt, now we want the money. And there's a series of those letters that go through a sequence. And the letters get progressively more stern. They start out very polite. Maybe you've misplaced our last correspondence. Maybe it slipped your mind. You owe us some money. You know, then it gets progressively more stern to the point where they issue what's called a final notice of intent to levy and notice of your right to appeal. That is the final notice letter that gives you it gives you 30 days to pay, or if you don't pay within 30 days, it gives you an opportunity to file an appeal. And only if you miss that 30-day appeal period can they start enforcement action. And then what typically happens, Rose, is you'll get a levy notice from the IRS. You're not going to get a phone call threatening to put you in jail. You're going to get a levy notice. And so, again, I reiterate that any phone call that threatens to put you in jail if you don't pay money today is an absolute scam. Do not fall for it. Hang up the phone and don't give it a second thought.
All right. And then what about audits? Can we challenge an audit or not?
Well, yeah, absolutely. In fact, this, you know, people need to know this. I wrote a book called How to Win Your Tax Audit that talks very specifically about the procedures that are available when you're dealing with the IRS in an audit situation. The thing that people need to know, Rose, about dealing with an audit is that the burden of proof is on the taxpayer. And this trips people up. The burden of proof is on you. The IRS never has to prove you made a mistake. You have to prove you did it right, okay? They don't have to prove you did it wrong. You have to prove you did it right. And so this is important for people to understand that they have to provide evidence to the IRS that is going to establish that they're entitled to the deduction they claimed on the tax return. If you've got business expenses deducted on your return, just as an example, whether it's mileage or travel expenses or advertising costs, I don't care what they are, you've got to establish that you paid the amount you say you paid. You've got to establish that it was paid for the purposes you say you paid it for. And you got to prove that it was paid during the year that you wrote it off. So I mean, those are the basic things you have to prove. Now, here's the thing you need to understand. 88% of every person that goes through a tax audit ends up owing more money to the IRS. All right? But the problem is the IRS's audit results are wrong between 60 to 90% of the time. But what happens is the vast majority of people that go through a tax audit don't challenge the auditor's decision. And this is what you need to know. You've got the right to challenge that decision. You can file an appeal within 30 days of what they call the examination report, and that your case gets pushed into the Office of Appeals. And Rose, the written job description of the appeals office is to negotiate settlements with taxpayers. So that's always where you want to be in these appeal cases.
Oh, and then once you get audited, do you get flagged in the computer and checked on every year?
No. That's certainly not necessarily true. What happens in an audit situation is the IRS tries to audit the 3 years that they're basically 3 years that are open at any one time. The IRS has got 3 years from the date you file your tax return in which to make an assessment and declare that you owe more money. If they can't do it within 3 years, the statute of limitations expires. There are some rare circumstances in which they can go longer than 3 years, but for the garden variety taxpayer, for just about everybody listening to us, it's a three-year rule. So if you filed your 2013 tax return in April of 2014, you count forward 3 years, you get April of 17. So we're past that now, so your 2013 tax return is closed. It can't be audited. But if the IRS starts looking at 14, you know, they may want to look at 15 and 16 as well. If they're looking at 15, they might want to look at 14 and 16. So they try to get that three-year window, but it doesn't mean at all that you're going to be audited for every year. And, in fact, it's unusual that anybody is ever audited every year, year in and year out, in a face-to-face audit situation. Now, understand, Rose, that the face-to-face audits, you know, there's about 1.5 million to 2 million of those audits that are done every year. And this is where the IRS, you know, basically sends you a letter, and you have to go into the office, or you got to provide information through the mail, one way or the other. Most audits are done electronically, and most audits are done through the correspondence process. And so it's you know, there's a lot more of those, obviously. But even at that, the chances of being audited every single year going forward is just they're slim and none.
So, how long do you have to save all your receipts?
Well, that's a good question, and what I recommend is that people save them for 7 calendar years, 6 years from the date you file your return. Save your records for 7 calendar years. Beyond that, Rose, it is almost impossible that the IRS can go back farther than that. Now, having said that, I do also recommend that you keep your filed copy of your tax returns indefinitely. So you know, you should have a single storage box with every tax return you've ever filed in that box. Because here's the problem with that: if no tax return is filed, if you don't file a return, then the IRS can go back 10, 12, 15 years. There's no limitation on how far they can go back to collect a tax return and assess a tax when you didn't file the return. So if the IRS for some reason says you didn't file, you got to prove you did. The burden of proof is on you to prove that you did file a return. So that's why I recommend you, first of all, that you file the returns with certified mail, or make sure you get your electronic filing confirmation number, your confirmation certificate. Make sure you have that in your records, and I recommend you keep that indefinitely.
Well, I didn't know that dead people had to file tax returns, but I found out that they do.
That which people?
Dead people.
Well, the estate of a deceased person, Rose, has to file the tax return for the decedent for the last period that they're alive. So, for example, if somebody passes on June 28th, the executor of that person's estate would file their last tax return that would show their income from January 1st to June 28th.
That's quite a burden for some people if they don't have access to somebody else's records.
Well, that's exactly right. It can be very difficult to do, no doubt.
Yeah. So, is the person who's like the trustee, if they can't find the records, held accountable for not being able to find the records of people who passed away?
Well, the individual is not, but the estate can be responsible. It depends on the scope of the problem. First of all, Rose, the vast majority of people out there are wage earners. And so if you've got a wage earner that passes on June 28th, just for example, you could get the wage information from the employer right away and then file the tax return based on that.
Well, what about is there any way to avoid an audit so you're never audited, hopefully?
Well, in my book, How to Win Your Tax Audit, I talk about audit-proofing strategies. I talk about a procedure that allows you to provide information with the return that answers potential questions raised in the return. What you have to understand, Rose, is how the vast majority of tax returns are selected for audit in the first place. What happens is the IRS has a very sophisticated computer program they call the Discriminant Income Function System. It's called the DIF program. And what it does is it compares every line of your tax return with national and regional statistical averages for a person in your same income category and profession. If any line of your return is out of sync with those averages, the difference is scored. It's called the DIF score. And the higher the score, the more likely you are to be audited. The higher the score, the farther away from the national averages your entries on the return are. So maybe you've got, and so you file a tax return, for example, that shows that's flagged because of your charitable contributions. Well, if you're tithing based on your income, you're giving 10% of your income to your church or charitable organization. Well, you're giving charitable gifts at three times the national average. So that may be flagged for examination. So in that situation, if you're giving money at that rate, you might use my audit-proofing strategies that involve using Form 8275, IRS Form 8275 is called the disclosure statement, and that allows you to provide information with the tax return that will answer any potential questions raised in the return, and that often eliminates the chance of a face-to-face examination.
Well, speaking of charities, this is off the wall. You just pushed a little button in my head and turned on a light bulb. What about something like the Clinton Foundation, who kept 95% of the donations? Didn't they have to file a disclosure of where
went? All these charitable organizations have to file disclosures. They're 990 forms. I'm no expert, Rose, on charitable foundations, so I can't tell you what exactly they're supposed to do to be in compliance. But they do have to file disclosures. There's a Form 990 that is typically filed. It's a tax return for the information return for tax exempt organizations. Yeah, they have to be filed for sure.
That would be interesting. And then what about the IRS? Can they go and start contacting your bank and your friends and your neighbors, employer?
You know, it's a good question, Rose, and it's humanly possible that they can do that. Put it this way, they got the legal authority to do it for sure. And in fact, when you're contacted by the IRS in an audit situation, one of the things that they say in the letters that they send you is that they do have the right to contact third parties. They also say that in a collection letter. If they send you a letter that says you owe money, I talked earlier about these collection notices, they will tell you that they can contact third parties. However, it is not a routine matter that they go out and contact third parties for information. It can happen. The most common third-party contact, Rose, is the IRS to summons your bank account, or your bank, rather, to get your bank records, your bank statements and deposit slips and so on. So, for example, if you're under audit and you're not cooperating with the audit and the IRS wants information about your income for the years in question, it is not unusual for them to summons those records from the bank. Now, there's a process they have to go through to do that. They can't just show up at the bank steps and say, give us the records for, Mr. and Mrs. John Smith over here. They can't do that. There's a process they have to go through. There's notification requirements that the IRS has to meet, and they will meet them. They'll send the taxpayer the notices and basically give them a heads up on what's going on. The taxpayer has a right to object to that and to complain about it and so forth, and there's some checks and balance procedures in there. But I talk about this in the audit book at length, How to Win Your Tax tax audit, I talk at length about how to prevent those third-party contacts and what to do to keep the IRS from going to third parties to get information.
Yeah, that's awful. And what about if there was a natural disaster or a fire or something and you lost all your records? How would you reconstruct them, or how would you approach that?
Well, yeah, reconstruction is the answer. I mean, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of people get themselves into trouble for exactly that reason. You know, there's a fire, flood, hurricane, natural disaster of some kind, illness, injury, death in the family, you know, a failed business, failed marriage, any number of problems that put people into a position where they don't file their tax returns on time, either because they don't have records or they're just not able to get the thing done, you know, correctly and promptly, and it puts people into a position where they get behind the eight ball with the IRS. And this is one of the things that I talk about quite at length in most of my books. In fact, I focus on this in the book, The IRS Problem Solver. I talk about penalty cancellation. You know, the IRS issues about 35 million penalties against individuals and businesses every year. And the vast majority of those penalties can be canceled if people would step up and demonstrate that the penalty doesn't apply. Now, I talked earlier about the burden of proof. I mentioned the burden of proof is on the taxpayer in an audit. Well, the burden of proof is on the taxpayer in a penalty situation as well. The IRS will, quote-unquote, automatically issue the penalty rose, but you as the taxpayer have the right to object to it and request that it be canceled. If you can demonstrate that you acted in good faith and based on a reasonable cause for your actions and didn't deliberately disregard IRS rules and regulations, the penalties don't apply. The penalties only apply to what they call willful or deliberate misconduct, deliberate attempts on your part to fail to do what the law requires you to do. If you're a victim of a fire, flood, or hurricane and you lost your records and you couldn't file your return on time, that's not deliberate failure to file. That's not the kind of willfulness that's required to sustain a penalty. So what you got to do is you got to present facts to the IRS that will allow the reader to come to the conclusion that you didn't deliberately disregard your responsibilities, but rather there was an impediment to filing, such as lost records or an illness or injury or any of those things we talked about. I talk about it at length in the book, The IRS Problem Solver. I go through a litany of different strategies and different examples, different scenarios for you. And we've got a tremendously effective process of getting rid of penalties that will cut tax bills substantially. You know, I've heard people tell me 1,000 times, I can pay my taxes. It's the penalties and interest that are killing me. If I could just get rid of the penalties and the interest. Well, when you can demonstrate reasonable cause, good faith and reasonable cause, you can get rid of the penalties. That'll cut the interest on the penalties, and that generally reduces the bill considerably.
I have about two or three more questions for you. Can you stay with us for a few minutes?
Sure.
Okay, I'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Colombo Chronicles, live with Rose Colombo and her guest, Dan Pila, author and expert on taxpayers' rights. So don't touch that dial.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Colombo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Colombo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to ColomboChronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Colombo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColomboChronicles.com.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, we're back, and we're speaking to Dan Pila, author and expert on taxpayers' rights. Dan, when you were talking about penalties and interest, I thought that the government couldn't charge excessive penalties and interest. That seems very excessive to me. how they charge these excessive, in my opinion, penalties and interest when the person can hardly pay what they owe.
Well, you know, that seems like a good question. If you can't pay the tax, what makes them think you're going to pay the penalties and the interest? And you know, and the Congress takes the position, Congress wrote the law, Rose. I mean, this is in the Internal Revenue Code. There's over 140 different penalty provisions in the tax code that clobber people in dozens of different ways. So, you know, I think they're excessive too. But the fact of the matter is that these cancellation procedures are in the law, and if you know how to use them, you're going to get rid of most of the penalties.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us, our audience, a little bit, they're asking, a little bit about your background, because I had mentioned a little bit about your dad's problem, and they want to know a little bit more about your background and how you got started and why you have such a passion for helping people with their taxes.
Well, yeah, as you said at the top of the program, Rose, my dad had a small business here in our hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota, got behind on his employees' taxes, and the IRS closed him down in 1974. They padlocked the doors, and as you said, they auctioned his equipment off, and then in 1978, 79, several years later, they turned their attention to our family home and tried to seize and sell it for the back tax liability. And that's when I got started in this area. I came home one day, and my mom was sitting at the table with an envelope from the IRS, and she hands it to me, and she says, "What do you make of this?" And I read it, and I said, "Well, it looks like they're going to try to seize the house." And she said, "Well, you know, what do we do about that?" And, of course, I had no idea what to do. I was about 18 years old at the time. And so what I did is I went over to the local law school library, and I just started fumbling around in the Internal Revenue Code, not even knowing what I was looking for, Rose. I'm just fumbling around in this tax code, knowing nothing about the Internal Revenue Service or the tax laws or anything, and I just literally stumbled onto an area of the tax code that deals with taxpayers' rights issues and IRS problems resolution, and I start reading in this section, and I didn't get six pages into this section of the code, and I discovered that the IRS was proceeding illegally to seize that home. It was my father's tax debt from his business. My mom had nothing to do with the business. She had nothing to do with the tax liability. She didn't owe the tax, and yet they're trying to seize her interest in the house, you know, to pay his taxes. And so, you know, it didn't seem all that right to me based on what I read. And so, based on that, Rose, I did what any 18-year-old would do. I sued the IRS using the forms that I found in the library and the procedures I read about. I filed a lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service, and I found myself too long after that, I found myself in a federal courtroom in Minneapolis, and I'm arguing in front of a federal judge that the IRS should be stopped from seizing this property. And the IRS justice, the IRS flew an attorney in from the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., and they were arguing to have my case tossed out of court. And so I said, "Judge, you know, the law says this, and they're trying to do that, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with it." And I sat down. My argument was about that polished. You know, it just wasn't anything to it. And this attorney stood up, and he blathered on and on about court cases this and code sections that, and I had no idea what the guy was talking about. But when he was finished, the judge looked at him and pointed at me and said, "He's right." And he slammed the gavel, and I thought, well, this is easy. and so I was able to stop the IRS from taking the house. Now, Rose, here's the interesting part of the story. In between the time that they closed down my dad's business, actually earlier than that, in between the time that he got in trouble in the first place, and that day in that courtroom in Minneapolis, my dad got involved with the tax protester movement. These are the folks that say that the tax laws are unconstitutional and the 16th Amendment was never ratified and, you know, it's a violation of your Fifth Amendment rights to sign a tax return, all these various arguments that these people make. I'm sure you've heard all kinds of different things. Well, my dad got involved in that movement as well, see? And so what happened is his tax protester buddies were in the courtroom that day when the judge stopped the IRS from taking the house. And so, they all had tax problems. They, you know, that's what goes along with being a tax protester. You got tax problems. And so
right.
by the time I got home to my mother's house, they were lined up at the door. And they said, "Can you help me with my tax problem?" I said, "Sure, baby. I'm undefeated. Let's go here." So it was an instant practice of helping people with serious kinds of tax problems that they otherwise weren't getting any help with. And I approached every problem, every new case, which at that time every case was a new case, I approached every situation with two simple questions, the two questions that I stumbled on in evaluating my mom's situation. The two questions that I asked is, what is the IRS doing in this case, and what does the law allow them to do? And through my research and studies, I realized that the answer to those questions was two different things in virtually every case. In other words, the IRS was not following its own rules. It was not following the law that was supposed to follow in order to carry out the actions it was trying to carry out. And so I had tremendous success early on stopping the IRS because they were just violating their own procedures in case after case after case. And you know what, Rose? It's not that much different today. And as a matter of fact, the National Taxpayer Advocate, in I think it was 2014, she wrote a report that I could have written about taxpayers' rights. Now, I've been talking about the IRS not telling people the truth about their rights. I've been saying this for 25 years. My first book was released in 1986, and that's when I started talking about this stuff. I've done thousands of radio shows over the years talking about the IRS not telling the truth about taxpayers' rights. Well, in 2014, in her annual report to the Congress, the National Taxpayer Advocates annual report to Congress, she said she actually reported the results of a survey she did. In the survey, she asked 1,000 taxpayers whether two questions: do you believe that you have any rights, and if so, do you know anything about them? All right. Well, fewer than 50% of the people realized they had any rights, and less than half of those understood anything about them. So she says, not only do people not know what their rights are, but she went on and she said, the IRS doesn't tell the truth about those rights in situations where they're required to tell taxpayers what their rights are. So she just echoed what I've been saying here for more than two decades, and that is, citizens have rights, they don't know what they are, and the IRS doesn't tell the truth about it. That's why it's so important for people to understand a little bit about what their rights are, educate themselves a little bit, because I'll tell you what, Rose, the federal income tax law touches every American, touches every citizen, touches non-citizens for that matter. I mean, virtually every decision you make in your life has tax consequences, whether you get married or divorced, whether you have children, or if grown children leave your house, if you buy a house or sell a house, if you start a retirement plan or you start taking distributions from a retirement plan, if you start a job or quit a job, if you start a business or close a business, if you elect to have this medical care or that medical care, if you send your kids to this school or that school, all these decisions, Rose, have tax consequences, and people don't know anything about them, and they don't know how to deal with the IRS when the IRS comes down the pike. It's the one agency of the federal government that can touch everybody at any time, and people don't know what their rights are, and that's got to change.
Yeah, it touches people from the time you're born. Now they hand them a Social Security card, so you're already in the system. And then if you aren't born because they decide to end your life before you take your first breath with abortion scissors, they still tax the taxpayers to pay for that now. So it's just they've thought of everything. I mean, whether
right,
you live
right.
or die at birth, you're going to pay taxes. And I mean, and then, like I said, after you die, you're still going to pay taxes.
Yep,
at
yep,
least you're
going
to have to file if you don't pay the taxes, right?
That's well, yeah, the estate does for sure, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
so
right.
I mean that's why I said dead people pay taxes. So there you go. Well, Dan Pila, I thoroughly enjoyed your interview, and thank you so much for being our guest. But now it's your time to shine. Please let our audience know how to contact you, what you do, and how to get your books.
Sure, yeah. The books we talked about, How to Win Your Tax Audit and How to Get Tax Amnesty for those folks that have a current tax problem right now, those books are all my books that are in print right now are available on my website, which is taxhelponline.com. That's all one word, no spaces of any kind, taxhelponline.com. There's a lot of free information on that website as well, Rose. Reports that I've written, research studies, all kinds of different things that are very informative for folks. Taxhelponline.com. You can check it out right now.
Thank you so much. And you have a great evening and much, much more success in helping people with their taxes, Dan.
All right. Thank you, Rose. Good night.
You're welcome. Good night. Well, Dan Pilla has left the building, and don't forget to go to taxhelponline.com, taxhelponline.com. You can also check out his books on Amazon.com, and he's got 14 books, not 11, so my mistake, and it's been corrected, and they're excellent books, so check it out, because everybody's affected by taxes one way or another. And I'm going to be back in just a moment, so don't touch that dial.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Hi, we're back on Columbo Chronicles Live, and we just left Authors and Experts Corner. We have a few minutes left for some new news breaking. Andy Biggs slams Robert Mueller. And this is what it says. There's big controversy between Mueller and Comey and the former FBI director and President Trump. Let's be honest, he says. Robert Mueller was a terrible pick to be a special prosecutor to investigate President Trump's connection with Russia. He is known to be a very close friend to former FBI Director James Comey, and that says more than enough for the whole story. The fact that the main actor is a best friend with somebody that is very important and a very important part of the whole story to unravel and for the truth to become public. And is anyone who dislikes President Trump more than Hillary Clinton? Is James Comey himself. Appointing Mueller as a special counsel was a terrible mistake by the Democrats, as they will soon find out that there is not a single piece of evidence that President Trump was connected to Russia. And now they probably will turn to the Michael Flynn case, where James Comey's testimony is essential to the whole investigation. Many believe that Michael Flynn is innocent of the accusations. Representative Andy Biggs had some sharp words to say about Robert Mueller as a special counsel. The Hill reported, his ability to be impartial is doubtful, because he has surrounded himself with highly partisan lawyers who make a special practice to line the coffers of Democrats. This investigation should not be centered around President Trump, as multiple high-ranking officials, including Mr. Comey and former President Director of National Security Intelligence, James Clapper, have stated that they have not seen any evidence that President Trump colluded with Russia or that he was under investigation. If Mueller wants to do any good, he should just resign, says this report by Representative Andy Biggs, from his position, as his whole investigation is in vain. So this is getting to be ridiculous, because the American people are tired of hearing about President Trump being in collusion with Vladimir Putin. the truth is that Obama had more connections with Russia. And during the campaign as well, in 2016, when President Trump was running for office, in fact, I read an article that alleged that former President Obama, a.k.a. Barry Sotoro, whoever he is, made a trip to Russia. So, I mean, they should just drop it. It's getting old, and people are tired of them wasting our tax dollars on this ridiculous issue. Americans have a brain. They know who they wanted. They knew who they wanted to vote for. They weighed the Democrats versus the Republicans, and many Democrats shifted over to the Republican vote, and the Republican president won fairly and squarely. That's it. I mean, these Democrats are acting like crybabies, like whiny children, like spoiled brats that never lost or were never told no. It's ridiculous. They need to grow up and be responsible and uphold their sworn oath to protect the sovereignty of this nation, to deport terrorists and radicals, dismantle the no-go zones, and make our country great again. They need to be nonpartisan, and they need to stand up for the U.S. Constitution and their sworn oath and uphold, defend, protect, and preserve the U.S. Constitution and stop all this ridiculousness that we're a Muslim nation and that we are under the ideologies of the Middle East. We are not. We are a sovereign nation. We are a republic run by the rule of law. We have three branches of government. And I don't know how they forgot who we are, but the American people are fed up. And it's time to remember who we are and what they were elected to do. And the only thing they're elected to do is uphold the Constitution, sovereignty, and to uphold the will of the American people and only pass laws that are in accordance with the U.S. Constitution, not in accordance with foreign ideologies that are in opposition to the Constitution and the will of the American people. And in fact, many of these Democrats need to stop spewing hate against the Republicans, inciting hate, inciting negative protests that are violent, inciting riots, inciting division, black-white division. We are the United States of America. We are not the divided states of America. And they're intentionally spewing hate speeches against the President of the United States, threatening a President of the United States with assassination, and laughing and joking about innocent Republicans who were shot on a baseball field. I've just never witnessed anything like this happening in our country, and I think it's shameful, it's degrading, and it can only open the door to vulnerability to enemies of this nation who think we are weak and divided and can't get it together. So it's time to wake up, stand up, and speak out for the President of the United States. Stand with him. Stand with the Constitution. Stand up for the Constitution, the U.S. flag, not just for yourselves, for your family, for fellow Americans and future generations. God bless you. Talk to you next Wednesday.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or, if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.